right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Today is Monday, October 22nd. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from our UBC campus and from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Today we have an interview with UBC journalism student and fellow CITR volunteer Wade Jordan, who gave us an update on the large protest happening today outside the legislature in Victoria on Vancouver Island. People from all over BC were protesting against the proposed Enbridge pipeline and against tanker traffic along BC's coast. Also today, we have a report produced by Erin Hudson from CKUT in Toronto on behalf of Groundwire News, which is part of the NCRA. The report is on the impacts of emerging nanotechnology in Canada's agriculture industry. We will also bring you our regular segment in Simply Science. Sarah Chow will be talking about daredevil Felix Baumgartner's stratospheric skydive.
All this, plus your weekday weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
The UBC newspaper reported yesterday that QP116 and UBC have reached a tentative agreement after weeks of strikes and 3 days of mediation. It has also been reported that all QP116 workers, including garbage collectors, campus mail workers, and custodial staff, return to work today, October 22nd. UBC QP116 had mediation sessions scheduled on Friday and Saturday, and they continued their talks through Sunday. Both parties reached a tentative agreement late Sunday night. The bargaining sessions, mediated by Vince Reddy, lasted 34 hours. The agreement still needs to be ratified in a vote by union members. QP116 President Colleen Garb said the union would likely vote on the agreement on Wednesday or Thursday of this week. The details of the deal haven't been disclosed, but Garb said she thinks the union should take the deal. Garb said that despite setbacks in negotiations, she is satisfied with the outcome.
UBC's unionized teaching assistants are not satisfied about how negotiations with the university are going, and they're taking a vote this Wednesday on whether to start striking. Based on a vote in March, the TAs, represented by the QP Local 2278, still have the ability to strike at any time. But because so much of their membership changes each year, union organizers are opting to take a large-scale vote from members this Wednesday before deciding on any job action. Everett said the decision to hold this large-scale vote this week was decided by about 10% of UBC's approximately 3,000 TAs who attended an emergency meeting last Wednesday on the 17th. Everett also said that she was still unsure what the response will be from union members in this vote. According to the QP 2278 Communications Director Trish Everett, a TA in the UBC Theatre Program, the bargaining committee isn't happy with UBC's offer. The offer doesn't address hiring preference for fifth-year PhD students or third-year master's students, one of their key demands, and it doesn't include the wage increase and tuition protection clause the union had been asking for. The offer would give TAs 2 years of 0% wage increases, followed by a 1.5% wage increase for both of the next 2 years. The director of UBC Public Affairs, Lucy McNeil, has said previously that if the TAs do strike, UBC may give students and staff another window to opt out of crossing picket lines. The vote will take place between 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. on Wednesday, October 24th, at the QP 2278 office at the UBC Village.
In other campus union news, QP 2950, the union local representing library, clerical, and Chan Center staff at UBC, has voted to accept a 4-year collective agreement with the university. The agreement, signed last Thursday, covers wages from April 2010 through March 2014. It includes 2 years of 0% wage increases and 2 subsequent years each with a 2% wage increase. The 2012 wage increase will be backdated to April of 2012. According to Union Vice President Edita Mekalek, over 700 of the union's 1,700 members attended a vote today to ratify the agreement. She says that 90% of the members voted in favor. The agreement still needs to be ratified on the UBC side by the Board of Governors, and according to a university bulletin, they are hoping to do this by next week.
In local news, the BC Ministry of Advanced Education has recently announced plans to commission textbook authors or developers to put together online textbooks for popular undergraduate courses. As a condition of funding, they'll be available through a Creative Commons license that makes them free for anyone to use, reuse, and revise. The BC Ministry of Advanced Education has promised to offer free online textbooks for 40 of the most popular post-secondary courses in the province. But it's up to professors to decide what textbooks are assigned within specific courses. After looking at data from BC schools and similar projects in Washington and California, the ministry will decide which courses will get free books. They expect to commission books for first-year courses like English, psychology, and calculus. Kiran Mahal, AMS Vice President, Academic and University Affairs, spoke to the UBC newspaper and agreed that free access to online textbooks would help make post-secondary education cheaper. But Mahal also stressed that the quest to make higher education more affordable should not end at textbooks. The government argues that the free textbooks will help more than 200,000 students save over hundreds of dollars per year. If all goes according to plan, some of the books will be available by September 2013.
And those are UBC campus and local headlines here on News 101. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay tuned for our interview with Wade Jordan, who reported live from the protest happening in Victoria today.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Commercial Drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. You can also listen to us online at citr.ca.
Before we go to Wade's interview, we've got our local weather forecast for the week, brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club.
Hi, Phil.
Hi, guys. Thank you, and good evening, listeners. Grayer skies are over us this afternoon. Bits of sunlight are getting through, but that is not going to be the case tonight, according to our rooftop model. After 8 p.m., we're expecting a light rain to start happening, carrying on into tomorrow, where a total of 8 millimeters of rain is predicted to fall from the heavens. Lots of low and mid-altitude clouds for both days, and winds in the vicinity of 10 kilometers per hour. Long-term forecast-wise, looking at the WARF 3 model provided by the University of Washington, the conditions look like they're going to get better for one day, about 24 hours, on Thursday due to a high-pressure ridge. But then the pressure is going to take a nosedive and the patterns are going to get more dynamic and wetter as two more low-pressure cells heads towards us here in Vancouver. Now, here are some forecast figures from Environment Canada. Today, mainly cloudy, 40% chance of showers late this afternoon, high of 10. Tonight, cloudy, a few showers beginning this evening, low of plus 5. Tuesday, cloudy with 70% chance of showers, high of 9. Wednesday, cloudy with 60% chance of showers, low of 6, high of 9. Thursday, cloudy, low of 5, high of 9. And finally, Friday, just before the weekend, cloudy with 60% of showers, low of 7, high of 10. So that's your five-day weekday weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club as well as Environment Canada. I'm Phil Chang, reporting for News 101. Thank you for listening.
And thank you, Phil. It is now time for our provincial and national headlines. To begin, we go to an interview with Wade Jordan, a UBC journalism master's student who was at today's protest outside the BC legislature in Victoria, where people were voicing their concerns over the proposed pipelines, oil tanker traffic, and a general lack of federal political will to move towards renewable energy sources. Here is the interview. So introduce yourself and tell me where you are.
Okay, I'm Jordan Wade, master journalism student at UBC, currently on the lawn of the legislature here in Victoria. It's thinning out now. At one point today, there was, at least 5,000-7,000 people down here, maybe. Lots of speeches by various activists and people that are basically speaking out against the pipeline proposals. The event today was called Defend Our Coast, and it was organized by a few different groups, including Greenpeace. Max Wilder of Greenpeace was here. Elizabeth May of the Green Party was here. Reuben George of Tsleil Waututh Nation was here. Many, many other speakers speaking out against proposed pipelines coming to the BC coast, both the Northern Gateway Pipeline proposal through to Kitimat and the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion from Tar Sands down to Burnaby.
Right. So what time did you reach there and what did you see when you got there?
I arrived about quarter to 11. Lots of people with signs walking up toward the legislature. Generally very people in a kind of excited yet peaceful mood. People had signs. A lot of people came on their bicycles. People were handing out flyers. Had some chants going. It was a very you could tell there was, as soon as you kind of came into the the legislature came into view in Victoria, you could tell there was a certain energy in the air that something big was happening today.
And what about the security? Was there anything to be concerned about in that regard?
I mean, there's definitely a lot of police presence around. Actually, you can see a lot more now, not so much earlier, because as I said, there was just thousands upon thousands, and now there's probably a few hundred left in the lawn. But what they have is this gigantic 235-meter long piece of black fabric.
Right.
Just stretching out throughout the legislature lawn, which is represented with the size of one of the tankers.
Right.
That would be coming into our BC harbors to collect the oil from the tankers. And technically, this is the legal action or the illegal action part of the afternoon, because you're not legally allowed to put any kind of stake into the lawn of the legislature. And they've got, I mean, it's hundreds of stakes to support this big, long piece of black fabric, which are currently in the lawn. Although right now there's some live music playing and some people are dancing, but up to this point there hasn't been any violence.
That's always good to hear. Could you talk to us about, have you talked to any of the people there? Have you heard from what they think is going on in terms of how strongly they agree with the message, or have you met people who are there to protest the protest?
No, most people here are vehemently opposed to the pipelines, are here to support the cause today, which is to defend our coast. I've heard many people say, you know, I'm willing to get arrested for it. Others I've heard say, oh, I can't get arrested, I'm going to leave now. But as I said, it's been quite peaceful to this point. I haven't seen any tussles with the cops or the authorities. But, you know, people are wearing their T-shirts. They've got their placards. They're quite outspoken about this issue. And you've got some really passionate British Columbians that have come together today to support this this very important cause for our province.
So did
and
you
for our nation.
Did you hear speakers like Elizabeth May and Jane Stirk talk?
I did. Elizabeth May, especially, was incredibly passionate. She was very vocal against the Harper administration, and she really riled up the crowd. It made some very, very educated and enlightening points to kind of rile the crowd about what the Harper government's agenda was.
That's good to know, because it is always important to know that there's somebody on the political level who agrees with the public and is trying their best to do something.
Oh yeah, I mean, she came right and said, "You've got 100% of the green representation in Ottawa here today." As a little joke off the top, of course, Elizabeth being the only elected green member of Parliament right now.
Right, right. All right then. Thank you so much. How long do you plan to stay there?
You know what, CJ, I'm going to try to catch this the next ferry back to Vancouver, just because as a UBC student, I've got a lot of work to do. But it was a great day. I'm really glad I came down. I had my video camera. I got lots of great footage and took some photos and met some interesting people. So it was definitely a trip with WOW.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Wade.
Thank you, CJ.
All right. Thanks to Jordan Wade for that insightful and informative interview. Here's some further context just for you guys regarding the ongoing protests. So as you heard, thousands have gathered on the front lawn of the BC legislature today, protesting the Northern Gateway Pipeline Project. The protest involves a collaboration of several groups who are strongly opposed to the transportation of crude oil from the Alberta tar sands into the port of Kitimat in British Columbia. The Northern Gateway protests have obtained endorsements and widespread support, ranging from environmental groups such as Greenpeace and Forest Ethics, to unions like the Communications, Energy and Paper Workers, CEP, the Canadian Auto Workers, CAW, the BC Teachers Federation, the Canadian Union of Public Employees, CUPE, and much more. Although the provincial government is not in session, Peter McHugh, a spokesman for the group Defend Our Coast, has said, quote, "We mean to deliver a message to Christy Clark and the federal government that British Columbians oppose these tar sands, tankers, and pipelines," end quote. Enbridge has estimated that opening up Asian markets to Canadian oil would boost Canada's GDP by $270 billion over 30 years and would generate $81 billion in direct and indirect revenues to the federal and provincial governments. Of that, BC would receive about $6 billion, while Ottawa would receive about $36 billion and Alberta receiving $32 billion. Regardless of the economic incentives, the main grievance for the protesters is the eradication of environmental laws and industrial pandering being conducted by the Harper government. Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, president of the Union of British Columbian Indian Chiefs, has said, quote, "The Harper government has clearly demonstrated that it is only their blatant sellout to industry agenda that matters," end quote. And the environmental laws also, quote, "are being systematically bulldozed aside in Parliament to the delight and benefit of tar sands development projects such as the Northern Gateway Enbridge project and the expansion of the Kinder Morgan pipeline," end quote.
Last week, it was announced that Haida Salmon Restoration Corp. had scattered 100 tons of iron sulfate and 20 tons of iron oxide in the international waters off the Haida Gwaii archipelago in what would become known as the world's largest iron fertilization project. The iron created a 35,000 square kilometer plankton bloom when added between July and September. Proponents argue that fish feeding on plankton will grow in number and size due to the increase in food supply. However, an investigation has now found that the iron dumped off the coast of Haida Gwaii was primarily a bid to sell carbon credits, not a scientific experiment, according to a marine conservation society working on BC's Pacific coast. The Living Ocean Society obtained correspondence between the Old Masset Village Council, which is running the project, and the Northern Savings Credit Union, which lent the council $2.5 million to finance that project. The documents were made available on the society's website and show the lender was aware that the ocean restoration project involved selling carbon credits. Living Ocean's executive director, Karen Riston, told the Vancouver Sun newspaper that she believes the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation, which is owned by Old Masset, is trying to create a carbon credit market through the plankton bloom, which it claims will capture and retain carbon dioxide while enhancing the local fishery. Under the United Nations London Convention, what is permitted is, quote, "legitimate scientific research," unquote, while dumping toxins at sea for other reasons is currently prohibited. John Disney, the economic development officer of the village of Old Masset and CEO of the Salmon Restoration Company, insisted in a news conference on Friday that the project does not violate any Canadian laws or international conventions.
In national news, the federal broadcast regulator gave an unequivocal thumbs down to BCE Incorporated's takeover of Astral Media on Thursday, declaring in no uncertain terms the $3.4 billion deal was not good for Canadians. The surprise announcement by the CRTC was announced after stock markets closed and marked the first major decision for newly installed Commissioner Jean-Pierre Blais, who took over in late June. Not only did Blais turn down one of the biggest takeovers ever submitted to the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission, he left little doubt about where he stood or how he would respond should BCE return with a modified but essentially similar proposal. The CRTC said BCE, owner of Bell Canada, the CTV television network, and numerous specialty stations, already has 33.7% of the English television viewing audience, well ahead of its nearest rival, Shaw Communications, with 21.9%. Had it succeeded in acquiring Astral Media's 25 channels and more than 80 radio stations into the BCE fold, it would have gained 42.7% of the English viewing audience. The combination would also have given it 33.1% of the French TV market. In response to these numbers, the regulator said, quote, that convergence, integration, and scale may lead to a point at which the size of an entity on a national level becomes so large that it hinders effective and healthy competition, end quote.
Shell Canada has failed in an attempt to use the federal government's new environmental assessment rules to try to bar Greenpeace from hearings on the company's proposed Jackpine oil sands mine in northern Alberta. In a letter to the agency conducting the assessment of the plan, Shell lawyers had argued that Greenpeace and two university professors no longer had standing under new rules contained in the Harper Tories omnibus budget bill. The letter, which added there could be others who should be denied a chance to appear before the panel, said exclusions were necessary to quote-unquote focus the review. The new rules limit presenters to those who are directly affected by a project or those who have relevant information or expertise. The lawyers said that meant some people who signed up to appear at the hearings when they begin October 29th are no longer qualified. The Shell letter specifically targeted Greenpeace campaigner Keith Stewart, who had planned to present a report entitled Harper's Shell Game: Why Tar Sands Pipelines Are Not in the National Interest. It also mentions two York University professors, Anna Zelik and Isaac Osuka. Stewart and Shell's original letter is... Stewart said Shell's original letter is proof that the federal Tories are deliberately trying to restrict debate around resource projects. But in a letter released late Wednesday, the agency turned down Shell's request. It said panel members were capable of keeping things on track. The constitutional challenge is to be heard on October 23rd.
And now we go to a report produced by Aaron Hudson from CKUT in Toronto on behalf of Groundwire News, which is part of the NCRA. The report is on the impacts of emerging nanotechnology in Canada's agriculture industry.
Nanotechnology is the manipulation of matter on an extremely small scale, working with materials that are measured in nanometers, which are 1/1,000,000th the size of a meter. Nanotechnology is increasingly being used in many industries worldwide, including agriculture and food production, though in Canada, standards on the use of nanotechnology are yet to be established. Research specialist Renzo Dallavia works at Ontario's Workplace Safety and Prevention Services and is the chairperson for the Canadian Standards Association. He is currently working on the association's nanotechnology committee. Dallavia was asked recently to give a presentation to the attendees of the Canadian Agricultural Safety Association on what nanotechnology is and the impacts it could have on Canadian farming practices.
Dependent on, and there's no doubt in my mind and or anyone else working in nanotechnology, there's no doubt that it isn't already. If not already, it will reach the farm. It'll reach the agri industry, Canada and internationally. I must tell you though, up front, for the most part, much of the technology is still at the bench, the lab bench at the university, in the innovative phases, and they're slowly getting to the point where they're going to be seeking approvals. So the one thing that is rather evident is that it is an emerging technology or emerging technologies. So where will some of the real benefits come? Well, let's just say the optimism is the creation of biosensors using nanomaterials, nanoparticles, nanofibers, nanosensors, such that in the very not too distant future, the agri-industry will be able to use these sensors on crops, on their fields, within their, you know, the animals. And these sensors will be able to give an intellectual or intelligent message to the agri-industry, back to the farmer. So likely some of the hypothesis is that these sensors will be able to sense moisture content, temperature, perhaps fungal and or bacterial infections coming in long before there is visible sense of it. They're already, incidentally, believe it or not, using it. That's why I said, you know, it's already there at the farm. It's just that it's sort of in the background. You know, if I have a wind turbine, it's likely, you know, you have nanotech, but it's stable. It's not going to come out of its product. You already have it in the coatings that are applied on the tractor. You know, there's already much already there. So, you know, AGRA will benefit and is benefiting and will continue to benefit.
Executive Director of the Canadian Agricultural Safety Association, Marcel Hacot, explains what he hopes conference goers will get from Dalavia's conference presentation.
We know what's out there. So nanotechnology is already here. So I guess our role, the way we're looking at it, is are there some risks or hazards associated with that nanotechnology? We've heard there's some solutions that could probably be provided by nanotechnology. And then we don't know if there are any hazards. So I guess our hope is that we get Renzo in, gives us a bit of an idea of where we're at, where the knowledge is at, so that the people, when they leave the conference, can say, okay, I think I understand where we're at in nanotechnology and agriculture. So if somebody asks me about it, I'll be able to give an informed opinion.
So what will Dalavia's message be regarding concerns about nanotechnology?
Is there concerns? Well, of course there's concerns. Like in any use of any product, there always should be concerns. And if for no other reason than if I ask a question and there's no definitive answer to, yes, it's safe, then one needs to assume if you can't answer that, then you err on the side of caution. The one thing that's absolutely, without a question, we need to go hand in hand, ensure that there are regulations, that we're confident that the materials that are going into the products are safe, and that there are means of measuring. So, you know, that's no doubt, but that's not just strictly with nano, it's with everything else. When one looks at nanotech, it's tough to really visualize where it will eventually go because there's so much investment and it's such a clever way of doing things. But it's everywhere.
This story was brought to you by Aaron Hudson from CKUT in Montreal, Quebec.
And thank you to Aaron Hudson from CKUT for that segment on behalf of Groundwire News, which is part of the NCRA.
Those are your provincial and national headlines on News 101. It is now time for our weekly science segment, Simply Science, by Sarah Chow.
Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow.
I know the whole world is watching now, and I wish the world could see what I see. And sometimes you have to go up really high to understand how small you are.
That was Felix Baumgartner describing what it was like standing 39,045 meters above the Earth. And I'm assuming by now you've all heard about Felix Baumgartner. Well, if you haven't, here's the scoop. On October 14th, an Austrian skydiver / daredevil / base jumper jumped from the Earth's stratosphere and reached the speed of 1,342.8 kilometers per hour, which is faster than the speed of sound. His jump broke two other records for highest free fall and highest manned balloon flight. This record was originally set in 1960 by Joseph W. Kittner, a former command pilot. He also helped direct Baumgartner on his record-breaking dive back to Earth. So, what did it feel like to break the sound barrier?
It's hard to describe because I didn't feel it. You know, when you're in that pressure suit, you don't feel anything.
Yeah, pretty anticlimactic. But the science that went into his death-defying feat was not. To get Baumgartner up 40,000 meters above Earth required a helium balloon made out of strips of high-performance polyethylene plastic. If you laid out all these strips side by side, it would be enough to cover 40 football fields. Attached to the balloon is a capsule. This capsule is made to withstand temperatures of nearly minus 57 degrees Celsius, which is the temperature of the stratosphere. But what happens when he jumps out? Well, he wore a pressure suit to protect him. It was insulated to hold up against temperatures between 38 to minus 67 degrees Celsius. Just think, the coldest temperature recorded here in Vancouver, British Columbia, is a mere minus 17.8 degrees Celsius, which is nothing compared to what Baumgartner's suit had to endure. Oxygen is another problem. In the stratosphere, the air is very thin, so the suit is pressurized to deliver oxygen, much like an airplane cabin. Same concept. Now, if he had no suit and just jumped out, the water in his body would turn into gas, causing his body to expand and eventually blow up. Not a good way to go. So, who designed the suit? A team from David Clark, a company based in Massachusetts. One of the team members is actually a Canadian. Shane Jacobs was working at the University of Calgary Sports Performance Lab when he was asked to take part in this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Baumgartner was also equipped with a main parachute and a reserve for his landing, as well as a drogue stabilization chute and a G-force meter. Because the air he's jumping into is incredibly thin, there's very little drag and resistance, which is a good thing for him to break the sound barrier. But without friction, he falls very fast, and things can get out of control pretty quickly. When deployed, the drogue chute will help to stabilize him, and he almost had to use it, especially when he started to spin right after jumping out of the capsule.
No, there was a period of time where I really thought I'm in trouble because I have a manual push button where I can release a drogue chute, which pulls me out of the flat spin. But at the same time, I knew if I push that button, this thing is all over. We're not going to fly supersonic. And it's hard. When you fall down at that speed, you have to make that decision. You know, somehow you have to make that call. Do I push that button and stay alive, or do I fight all my way down and break the speed of sound? And after a couple of seconds, I had that feeling, I get it under control, and I did. And that's the reason why we broke the speed of sound today.
It was a good thing he went to see a sports psychologist before his jump. A G-force meter was also attached to the drogue chute to monitor the amount of G-forces on his body. So if Baumgartner experienced 3.5 Gs for a continuous 6 seconds, it would deploy. 3.5 Gs basically feels like you're 3.5 times heavier than you actually are. For example, if you weighed 150 pounds, you would feel like you weighed 525 pounds. With that amount of force on your body, can make anyone pass out. So how does Baumgartner's jump help mankind? It has given NASA a better idea on how to improve on self-contained space escape systems to avoid lives lost in space and give them a fighting chance. So, what's next for Baumgartner?
It's way more difficult than everything that I've done so far, and I think I'm done.
Over the coming weeks, I'll be covering the Nobel Prize winners this year, so make sure you tune in. Same bat time, same bat channel. Well, that's it for this week for Simply Science for CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm Sarah Chow.
Thanks to contributor Sarah Chow for that segment. You can also listen to all our past interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. Before we go to Democracy Now!, we'll just have some quick PSAs brought to you by CITR.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beach Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing, Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Just a reminder, you can listen to our interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. It is now time for our international headlines, and for that we go to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. We're on the road in San Rafael, broadcasting from the Community Media Center of Marin. Both the U.S. and Iran are denying claims of having reached an agreement in principle for direct one-on-one nuclear talks. The New York Times reported Saturday a deal had been struck between U.S. diplomats and top Iranian officials, reporting to Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Iran is said to have asked that the talks be delayed until after the upcoming November elections so they could know with whom they'd be sitting down. But in a statement, the White House said, quote, it's not true that the United States and Iran have agreed to one-on-one talks or any meeting after the American elections. Speaking to journalists, Iranian Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Salehi also denied the report.
We don't have anything like discussions or negotiations with America. Yes, we have negotiations with the 5+1 group of nations. If it is about nuclear talks, the talks are going on with the P5+1 group of nations. Except that, we have no discussions with the United States.
The news comes as Iran grapples with a plunging currency and growing internal hardship in the face of crippling international sanctions. More broadly, Iran has proposed the establishment of a nuclear-free Middle East, but that call has gone all but ignored. A gunman killed 3 people and wounded 4 others at a Wisconsin spa Sunday before taking his own life. The shooter, Radcliffe Houghton, had recently been put under a restraining order and called upon to surrender his guns over a domestic violence case. All 3 of the dead victims were female. One was reportedly Houghton's estranged wife. President Obama and Republican challenger Mitt Romney square off in Boca Raton, Florida tonight for a third and final debate focusing on foreign policy. On the campaign trail in Virginia, Obama debuted a new dig at Romney, saying his opponent's alleged wavering on political stances can be explained as a case of Romneysia.
He's forgetting what his own positions are, and he's betting that you will too. I mean, he's changing up so much and backtracking and sidestepping. We've got to name this condition that he's going through. I think it's called Romneysia. That's what it's called.
And tonight, Democracy Now! Will continue our expanding the debate series. We're here in California and will be broadcasting the presidential debate. After Bob Schieffer asks his question and Mitt Romney and President Obama each respond, we'll stop the tape and we'll get responses from Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein and Justice Party presidential candidate Rocky Anderson. Then we'll go back to Boca Raton for the next set of questions. That's expanding the debate series as we continue to break the sound barrier. Unrest has broken out in Lebanon following the assassination of a top intelligence official in a car bombing. The killing of Brigadier General Wissam al-Hassan prompted calls of Syrian involvement, leading to protests at the end of Hassan's funeral. On Sunday, militants traded fire in areas of southern Beirut hours after mourners tried to storm government offices. The Israeli Navy has seized a ship of Palestinian solidarity activists seeking to break the U.S.-backed siege of the Gaza Strip. The Estelle was the latest boat attempting to reach Gaza as part of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition. On Saturday, Israeli Navy vessels surrounded the ship and deployed forces on board to seize the passengers, taking them to a prison inside Israel. The passengers and crew were nationals from Canada, Israel, Norway, Sweden, and the United States. Hours before the Israeli raid, ship organizer Matthias Gardel spoke to Democracy Now! From aboard the Estelle.
We are not breaking any laws. We are not the provocateurs.
It is Israel that clearly violates international public law and decent human standards. They are provoking the world, and by doing so, by inviting the world to witness this crime against humanity, they are also presenting each and every one of us with a choice. Either to choose to be part of the problem or to choose to be part of the solution.
A lawyer for the detained passengers has accused Israel of using taser weapons during the raid on the ship, saying Israeli forces committed, quote, electro-torture. Israel has denied the claim. In related news, author and professor Noam Chomsky made his first trip to the Gaza Strip over the weekend, appearing at an academic conference. During his visit, Professor Chomsky said he was inspired at witnessing how Palestinians survive under the Israeli occupation and later expressed solidarity with the detained Estelle passengers seeking to break the blockade.
The main impression is how inspiring it is to see people living under extreme duress, but nevertheless remaining vibrant, vigorous, active, hopeful, resilient, and continuing to struggle.
I should say that every time Israel stops a boat, that's another blow to its diminishing legitimacy and another element of support, both to those who are resisting internally and to those who are opposing the policies outside. And sooner or later, the wave will sweep over the barriers.
In other news from the occupied territories, Palestinians held their first vote in 6 years over the weekend with a round of municipal elections. The vote took place only in the West Bank as the governing Hamas movement held a boycott in Gaza following the breakdown of unity talks with the rival group Fatah. Police in Kuwait cracked down Sunday on a crowd of thousands of protesters opposing the ruling monarchy's effort to change electoral laws. The U.S.-backed Kuwaiti regime has stoked anger after dissolving parliament and proposing voting laws that opponents have described as a constitutional coup. On Sunday, an estimated crowd of up to 50,000 gathered across the capital, Kuwait City, in an attempt to march on government headquarters. At least 29 people were admitted to the hospital after police surrounded marchers and used tear gas and stun grenades to disperse them. Deadly protests have broken out in Panama over the sale of state-owned land within the duty-free area of Colón. On Friday, a 9-year-old boy was killed, several others wounded, when police opened fire on demonstrators who'd burnt tires and thrown projectiles. The shooting prompted further rallies over the weekend. Professor and protest organizer Carlos Baltazar said the demonstrators would continue.
We will continue with this peaceful event. The front does not want violence. The front wants the law to be repealed. The law has been approved irresponsibly.
The former South Dakota senator and Democratic presidential nominee George McGovern has died at the age of 90. Senator McGovern's best known for running against Richard Nixon in the 1972 presidential election on a platform of withdrawing U.S. troops from Vietnam. Memorial services are scheduled to begin Thursday in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We'll have more on George McGovern's life and legacy after headlines. And a federal judge has blocked a new state law in Arizona blocking funding for the reproductive services group Planned Parenthood. The law bans the use of public funds by state or local government to contract with any organization that provides abortions as one of its services. Planned Parenthood of Arizona won a temporary injunction Friday, extended a freeze on the law's implementation. Planned Parenthood has faced a crackdown in more than a dozen states, including in Texas, which last week threatened to shut down a health program for low-income women rather than allow Planned Parenthood to remain involved. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman at the...
Thank you to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! For those international headlines. More international news, we now go to Free Speech Radio News, where they talk about Obama and Romney potentially discussing the U.S. drone program.
President Barack Obama and challenger Mitt Romney meet in Boca Raton, Florida for their final debate tonight, which will mainly focus on foreign policy. The topics, which moderator Bob Schieffer has already announced, include red lines for Iran's nuclear program, America's longest war in Afghanistan, and the so-called rise of China. But some human rights activists here and around the world are calling for questions on the administration's increasing use of drones to carry out targeted killings. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Neither presidential candidate has spoken in depth about the CIA's drone program, which has killed hundreds of suspected militants and civilians in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. President Obama and his appointed officials have defended the program in interviews and speeches as constitutional and strategically important in the battle against terrorist groups. But some human rights experts, including Columbia Law School professor Noreen Shah, say both Obama and Romney should be pressed further in the final debate.
I think they have to answer for the fact that other countries are going to be acquiring this technology, and the U.S. is setting the example. It's setting the precedent. It's the first country that's using drone technology in this secretive way to strike people, to kill people, and it hasn't yet defined the limits of what it's doing. So if we're going to be setting an example for the rest of the world, they need to answer for what kind of example that's going to be.
Shaw led a study released earlier this month that shows that the most cited organizations tracking deaths from drone strikes, including the Long War Journal and the New America Foundation, greatly underestimate the number of civilians killed. The motivating factors to this discrepancy, she says, are restrictions on journalists in drone strike areas, the motives of local officials interviewed, and U.S. government secrecy.
We don't know how many strikes there have been. The U.S. government won't explain whether it's the CIA that's conducting strikes or U.S. special forces or some combination of the two. President Obama hasn't gone on national TV to explain why it's necessary to send drones to Somalia and Yemen, why we should be in those parts of the world, even if we're only there remotely with unmanned planes.
The Columbia Human Rights Clinic's report calls on the next U.S. president to investigate civilian deaths, track and release drone strike casualty information, and disclose the criteria used to target people. The next president may also have an even bigger secret arsenal at his disposal. Citing unnamed officials, The Washington Post recently reported a request from the CIA for 10 more drones on top of the more than 30 the agency already operates. Over the weekend, outgoing Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich made a statement accusing the CIA of trying to become a paramilitary force and said he would oppose the purchase unless the agency first conducts a public review of the drone program.
Are drones necessary? Are they wise? Do they make a bad situation even worse? Lacking a national intelligence estimate, approval of the request for more drones would be tantamount to doubling down on the dismissal of international law.
Some human rights advocates abroad agree with Kucinich that the strikes violate international law. Islamabad-based attorney Shahzad Akbar is bringing several lawsuits to courts in Pakistan on behalf of drone strike victims and their families. FSRN spoke to Akbar about these cases when he visited the U.S. this spring.
First of all, we have some homicide murder cases registered against CIA officials who were working in Pakistan on this. Then we have cases in High Court of Peshawar where we're challenging Pakistani government involvement in this and the intelligence agencies, and then also the failure of government to protect the life of their own citizens.
In the first case, Akbar is representing 45-year-old reporter Karim Khan, who says the CIA's Jonathan Banks and John Rizzo are responsible for killing his son and brother in a 2009 drone strike. The second case involves charges against Pakistani officials on behalf of 8 people who lost family members in a 2011 strike. They say their right to life under Pakistan's constitution was violated and that intrusions into the country's airspace should be seen as acts of war. A judge in Islamabad is set to rule this week on whether the case against the CIA officials can go forward. If it does, a Pakistani magistrate would call on Interpol to issue an international warrant for their arrest. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for today, Monday, October 22nd, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to get involved or give us an important news tip, please contact us on our website, news@citr.ca. Through our email, sorry, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands, right here on CITR 101.9 FM. And just to know, today's show was produced by CJ.
Thank you.